Well, last week, I gave a sermon and also gave a Bible study in Bloomington, Illinois. And it was, I was asked to speak in the Bible study on the subject of what is going on in the Middle East. And I find it interesting that whenever we have events happening like what is happening now between Israel and Lebanon, we get a lot more hits on our website. A lot more people are checking the website to see what is happening, and they want to hear what, we have to say in the light of Bible prophecy. And, of course, that dies down again afterwards. And I've noticed people checking our website here in Lansing more, too. I don't know if David Logan has noticed that, but I had a message yesterday last night from somebody in Barbados who had checked our website and said, by the way, David, that it was a really good website. So that's a compliment to David Logan, who's put our website together, and it's obviously having an impact. So it was very nice to read this letter last night from this person in Barbados who was very thankful for the website and said that they're going to be listening to the sermons that are given here in Lansing, which get put on the website, depending on how efficient David is. On Saturday night, so usually they're available within a few hours, and it's nice to know that people are checking that. Of course, when people do check our website to see what is happening and want to get our understanding from the scriptures as to what is happening, it doesn't last, because when things die down, then usually people go back to their former way of life and don't care so much about God. In fact, if you remember, after September the 11th, sales of Bibles were up considerably, and also sales of the Quran. I remember reading at the time that, I've forgotten what it was, but normally something like 600,000 copies a year of the Quran were published. But because of what happened that day in the next 3 months, I think they had to produce something like 6 million. It was a fantastic increase that people wanted so many copies of the Quran. But it was the same with the Bible. But I do remember, too, that well before the Christmas spending spree, sales of Bibles were back to normal. So, as soon as things seem to die down again, people lose interest. Well, it's been almost 5 years since September the 11th. Less than 4 years after Pearl Harbor, Germany and Japan were defeated. It's been 5 years since September the 11th, and we still haven't been able to deal with this problem of radical Islam. And now, of course, there are three major wars going on, and all statistics and all views say that the situation is worsening in all three daily at this time: Afghanistan, Iraq, and this war between Israel and Lebanon as well. Additionally, Somalia has fallen to Islamic fundamentalists. Sudan is under the control of Islamic fundamentalists. Whenever there is an election in the Middle East, Islamic fundamentalists, radical Islamists, whatever you want to call them, come to power. Islam is certainly very much on the move. It is the fastest-growing religion in the world. It is the fastest-growing religion in the United States, the fastest-growing religion in Britain. It is a phenomenon of our age. And I think 50 years ago, very few people would have thought that we would see anything like this. Cameron Armstrong, no relation to Herbert Armstrong, Cameron Armstrong is considered one of the greatest experts in the world on fundamentalism. She used to be a nun, but now has no religious beliefs at all. But Cameron Armstrong commented in an interview I saw with her, she said, when I was growing up in the 1950s, she said, it seemed like religion had been, thrown out, that it wasn't important anymore. And she says, now, at the beginning of the 21st century, we realize that nothing is as important as religion, that everything, our whole way of life, our society, is at risk because of this sudden rise of Islamic fundamentalism, and it threatens all of us. I think we need to understand there will never, ever be peace in the Middle East as long as Israel exists. And the Bible shows that Judah, which is the biblical name for Israel, because Judah is the Jews, and what we call Israel in the Middle East is just the Jews. Judah will still be there right up until end time events take place, the events that lead to the Great Tribulation. So it's important to understand that. Israel's existence means there will never be peace, because the terrorists will never accept the existence of Israel. That's what this war is about now with Hezbollah. Hezbollah, the party of God is what Hezbollah means, believes that Israel must be wiped off the face of the earth. And the Iranian president has said the same thing, that Israel must be wiped off the face of the earth. So we're not going to have peace. Now, in actual fact, that's not entirely true, because there will be a brief period of peace. Look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. You know, we need to make sure that spiritually we're very alert to these things, because I can see what's going to happen. You know, as we have these rising tensions in the Middle East, so we get more people coming to church, we get more people interested in the Bible. And yet when things die down again, then people lose that interest. But there is prophesied a coming period of peace. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul says in verse 2, "For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape." So, you know, when they shall say peace and safety, remember the whole focus of Bible prophecy and end time prophecy is really on the Middle East and Europe to a certain extent. But, you know, the Middle East is the central focus. You know, when Jesus Christ was asked, you know, what would be the sign of your coming? And in Luke 21, he talks about Jerusalem and what's going to happen to Jerusalem. So the Middle East is very much at the center of Bible prophecy. When they shall say peace, then sudden destruction will come upon them. And I think what we're heading for right now is there is going to be some sort of a peace that will come together with European involvement, which will give us peace for a while, but it will not last, because Hezbollah wants to destroy the nation of Israel. Israel cannot exist according to Islam. It's very simple, very simple. The teachings of Muhammad, once an area becomes Islamic, it must stay Islamic. It is a part of the Islamic Ummah, the community, UMMA, the community of Islam. And any nation that becomes Muslim must remain Muslim. Any person that becomes a Muslim must remain a Muslim. There is no going back in Islam. It does not allow for people to change religion. We've had that problem in the church for years. When we operate in countries like Malaysia, for example, it used to be a British colony, so, you know, it has a tradition of freedom of religion. You've got different religions there. The Chinese who live there, I think, are about 40% of the population. They can change religion as much as they want. But the Malays, who are Muslims, are not allowed to. So we cannot send our magazine to the Muslims in Malaysia. That was the policy when I was in the church back in the 70s. It was against the law, and if anybody received the literature, they would be executed. They were not even allowed to read anything of a Christian nature. That's how strict it was. And it is even more strict in some of the Muslim countries in the Middle East. There was a letter recently in the Lansing State Journal. Somebody had written an article on this particular point of how intolerant Islam is. And a lady with a Muslim name wrote a letter to the Lansing State Journal, and she said, yes, that is right. She said, anybody who rejects Islam must be put to death, no matter where they live, even in the United States, even here in Lansing. This is somebody living here in our midst, who, not in this room, I hope, but somebody who wrote and said, you know, you cannot change religion if you are a Muslim. And, you know, I cut out the letter. I've still got it at home. I may quote from it sometime in an article. But, you know, that is the thinking. And I've only ever known two people who converted from Islam. One was a pastor in Worldwide back in Nigeria in the 1970s, and he was cut off completely from his family, and he only got away with it, really, by leaving the country with his wife and children. And the other is one of our ministers in Ghana. And I put that down to Ghana being a laid-back society, Ghanaians are very friendly. And this is Pastor Adonijah, who pastors a congregation in Elmina. And he was a Muslim, and all his family are still Muslims. And, you know, often I will ask him questions about Islam. And, you know, he changed religion. And this is extremely rare that anybody does that. So, you know, there's an intolerance to Islam. You know, Hezbollah believes, and so does Iran, so does Syria. I mean, all Muslims really believe this, that Israel, which today is populated by Jews, belongs to the Muslims. They also believe that Spain belongs to the Muslims because it was ruled by Muslims for about 600 years. And so they want Spain back. And that's one reason why, you know, Spain was attacked a few years ago, the Madrid subway bombings. But any place that has ever been Islamic must always be Islamic. Then they believe that everybody else must also become Islamic. So, you know, their belief is that the whole world must be Islamic. You know, I say that there's likely to come a treaty here which will involve the European powers in the Middle East. There's an interesting prophecy in Daniel chapter 9, if you just turn there for a moment. In Daniel chapter 9, which I went through recently, I went through the 70 weeks prophecy. I would think that the tape of that is available on the website. But there is an alternative explanation of this particular passage of Scripture. I don't want to go through the 70 weeks prophecy again. That was a subject in itself. When I give it at ABC, it takes me 2 hours just to go through the 70 weeks prophecy. But remember, the 70 weeks prophecy is a very detailed prophecy of exactly when Jesus Christ's ministry would begin, the very year in which he would begin, also the very day on which he would die in the middle of the week, and how the sacrifices would be ended. So it's a very detailed prophecy. But there is an alternative interpretation of one part of the prophecy. This is what the evangelicals believe, and there are some people in the Church of God that believe this too. So I'll explain this because, you know, it will be something that comes up occasionally if you're watching. I mean, for example, one night this week, Jerry Falwell was on a TV program, and, you know, talking about this very point about us living in the end times, and, you know, their interpretation, which is, of course, different from our interpretation. But in Daniel chapter 9, we see how in verse 24, 70 weeks are determined. Again, I'm not explaining the 70 weeks prophecy, so we'll just quickly read through these two verses. 70 weeks are determined for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Now, we believe all of this. In fact, I think everybody believes that this is fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublesome times. Again, a very detailed prophecy of exactly when Jesus Christ would begin his ministry in 27 AD. And then it goes, and after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. So this is talking about the Romans coming in and destroying Jerusalem. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. So, you know, the fall of Jerusalem, the uprising of the Jews against the Romans. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. This is the problem sentence. Verse 27. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. We believe that the he there refers to the Messiah. And I think you'll find that Jewish commentaries say that that is the case. However, because half the previous verse talked about the Roman invasion of Judah and how the city would be ransacked and the sanctuary attacked and so on, some believe, and I believe the evangelicals all believe, The word he here refers to the modern descendants of the Romans, which would be, you know, the beast power, which is not in existence yet, but is, you know, coming together. So he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. So a lot of these countries in the Middle East will come to a kind of an agreement, a peace treaty here. He shall bring an end, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. Well, you know, if there is some sort of a peace treaty, then, you know, one thing that's going to have to be resolved at some point is Jerusalem. And I think Jerusalem is going to have to become an international city, meaning that no country would control Jerusalem. There would be international troops there to guarantee peace. This would enable everybody to have freedom of religion. It would enable the Jews to restore the sacrifices on the Temple Mount. And, you know, I think you've got to see something like that to see the fulfillment of some of the prophecies regarding that, because, you know, it does talk, not here, but it talks about the abomination of desolation again, and how it's going to be worse than the original abomination of desolation in the 2nd century B.C. But if this refers to the Europeans, then it says, in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. So the last part of the verse is talking about that time when the beast power desecrates the temple. But the first part of the verse, is it talking about the Messiah, or is it talking about this European power, this beast power coming down? You know, that's something that we have to wait and see. But, you know, if you hear any of these people on TV talking about this, that is what they are talking about. Now, with my wife's technical help, I'm going to show you a PowerPoint here, which will help you understand some of these things a little bit better. Very good book that I've been reading called Islamic Imperialism by Ephraim Karsh. His name is pronounced Ephraim. We normally say Ephraim, but he's Ephraim Karsh, and he's a Jew, but he's written a book which, you know, I can't find fault in his thinking or in his historical accounts. But I want to show you some of the things that he says here as a background to Islam and understanding Islam. Perhaps we could have the lights off, Chris, for this. Academic circles. His view is a minority opinion within academic circles, because most academics take the alternative view on Islam. And this is one of the problems that we have with our media, with our newspapers. So again, he says here, since September the 11th, there's been two diametrically opposed interpretations regarding the root causes of September the 11th. According to the first school of thought, the attacks were the latest salvo in the millenarian clash of civilizations between the worlds of Islam and Christendom. Millenarian means something that's been going on for over 1,000 years. And Islam began at the beginning of the 7th century. In fact, in 4 years, it'll be 1,400 years exactly since the religion of Islam began. So, although they date, their calendar is different, so they won't be celebrating that in 4 years' time. So there are those who believe that what's happening now is another round in this clash of civilizations between Islam and Christianity. Let's have a look at the second school of thought. Not so, argues a vast cohort of academics, journalists, writers, and retired diplomats. May I use the word intellectuals? Okay? This is what intellectuals think. The attacks were a misguided, if not wholly inexplicable, response to America's arrogant and self-serving foreign policy by a fringe extremist group whose violent interpretation of Islam has little to do with the actual spirit and teachings of this religion. Now, that is the dominant intellectual viewpoint. You look at any newspapers, the Lansing State Journal, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, would all think this way, that September the 11th was a direct result of America's foreign policy, and that all these problems in the Middle East today are a direct result of America's foreign policy, and then therefore it's all our fault, Okay? You know, this is liberal thinking. Liberals always think instinctively. Liberals always think immediately anything happens, they think, well, what have we done wrong? Never, you know, what's wrong with them? Never look at, you know, what might be behind what they're doing. It's always our fault, basically. That's the way our thinking is on CNN, on MSNBC, ABC, and a lot of the others. Now, Fox has got its own problems, but that's a separate issue. Come on, next one, here. Okay. Look at this quote. I was ordered to fight all men until they say there is no God but Allah. That was from Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad's farewell address in March of 632. So, you know, all men must be fought until everybody becomes a Muslim. Now, this one is a bit more chilling in some respects. I shall cross the sea to their islands to pursue them until there remains no one on the face of the earth who does not acknowledge Allah. This was Saladin in January 1189. Saladin was the man who defeated the Europeans in the Crusades. He drove the Europeans out. Now, if we can stay on this for a moment, Saladin was born in the town of Tikrit in what is now called Iraq. Saddam Hussein also comes from Iraq, from Tikrit, saw himself as another Saladin who would drive the Westerners, the Christians, out of the Middle East. And Saladin is there saying that everybody must acknowledge Allah, that everybody must become a Muslim. And that was, you know, very much in his thinking in January 1189. Now, don't think this is ancient history, because this is still the thinking now. See, nothing's changed. Let's have a look at the next one here. We will export our revolution throughout the world until the calls, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, are echoed all over the world. That's the Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979, who overthrew the Shah of Iran, which was really when Islamic fundamentalism emerged very suddenly, when America lost one of its greatest allies in the Persian Gulf, the Shah of Iran. And the Ayatollah Khomeini came to power. And, you know, look, here is this driving force behind their thinking that the whole world, again, must be Islamic. The next one, I was ordered to fight the people until they say there is no God but Allah and his prophet, Muhammad. And this is Osama bin Laden, November 2001. So 2 months after September the 11th. Now, those are just four quotes. You know, I could get you 400 if you wanted them along the same lines. But these are four people who show the thinking throughout the centuries. And Osama bin Laden, by the way, his followers liken him to Muhammad. Muhammad had a dream in which it was revealed to him, according to Muhammad and according to his followers, it was revealed to him that his followers would bring down the two greatest empires in the world. And they did. They brought down the Persian Empire and the Byzantine Empire, which were the two greatest powers in the world at that time. Osama bin Laden's followers claimed that he also had a dream, that his followers would bring down the two greatest empires in the world. His dream was in the 1980s, when he was fighting against the Russians in Afghanistan. And it was his followers that brought down the Soviet Union. And they believe that they can also bring down the United States, you know, defeat us, drive us out of the Middle East, and send us back to the Stone Age. You know, that's what their goal is. So it's a very serious threat. Okay, just moving on, let's have a look at some of these. Well, there's a picture of Osama bin Laden. That picture I took in Ghana, which is not a Muslim country. In fact, I took that in the city of Accra, the capital on the coast, where there are very few Muslims. So why would they be selling pictures at the side of the road of Osama bin Laden? Well, he has become a symbol to people all around the world that he is the man who humiliated the United States and will bring America down. And unfortunately, a lot of people who are not Muslims would like to see America brought down, as well as Muslims. And so he has become this kind of hero to people. A man who worked for the CIA or FBI, I've forgotten which, he was the head of their Osama bin Laden unit that was disbanded last month, was interviewed on the BBC recently. He made the comment, there is only one man who can unite the entire Islamic world. That's the man. Because everybody thinks he's a hero. And remember, in Islam, there's two major factions, the Sunni Islam and Shia Islam. The Shiites are the minority. They are usually the more fanatical. But even so, he said on this program on the BBC 2 or 3 weeks ago that he was the one man that could bring all the Muslims together. And I don't know whether that's going to happen or not, but that was an interesting observation. And that was somebody who was an expert on Osama bin Laden. Now, I want to show you, though, how this has been, this is a millenarian problem. Millenarian in that the clash between Islam and the West goes back 1,400 years. The purple bits there, this is from the 7th century. Muhammad died in 632 AD. Within 100 years, his followers had spread out. And everything purple there is the old Christian world, Christian as in Catholic or Orthodox. In fact, the Orthodox Church didn't exist at that time. It still was Catholic. The green part there is Islam, which started just here in Mecca and Medina. And then look how it spread by the end of the 7th century. And 100 years exactly after Muhammad died, Muslims reached Paris in France. And at the gates of Paris, they were defeated by Charles Martel, who was the grandfather of Charlemagne, one of Europe's greatest leaders. So Islam spread really rapidly. And look at these quotes. I've got a really good quote here, which I think is very perceptive. Hopefully it's the next picture here. This is a quote from the 7th century, I think, from the Egyptians. A Byzantine official, Egypt was a part of the Byzantine Empire at the time, which was a Christian empire, Christian in the Catholic or Orthodox sense. And look at what he wrote. We have seen a people who love death more than life, and to whom this world holds not the slightest attraction. And that was a comment made about the invading Arabs, the Muslims. Now, it's interesting because last Sunday, just 6 days ago, on Meet the Press, the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations was interviewed. It's a very good interview, and I have a recording of it at home, and I want to use it in an article. But he made the comment, he says, there will never be peace in the Middle East until the Muslims love their children more than they hate the Jews, which I thought was an interesting comment. But that day is not going to happen until Jesus Christ returns. You know, people, there's just something about the culture. They love death more than life. What better explanation is there of suicide bombing to love death more than life? I mean, it's just not natural for somebody to want to blow themselves up in order to take a few other people with them. You know, there's something perverse in the thinking. But as he said, we've seen a people who love death more than life, and to whom this world holds not the slightest attraction. So they don't desire to live like we do or to have the things that we have or our way of life. That's not a part of their thinking. When people possess the right insight into their affairs, nothing can withstand them, because their outlook is one, and they share a unity of purpose for which they are willing to die. This was a 14th century Muslim historian and sociologist, Abdulrahman ibn Khaldun. I'm sure you can all remember that. That's the biggest problem I have with writing articles on this, remembering all those names. But you see, he pointed out, you know, when people have a single-mindedness, a vision, nothing can stop them. And their vision is to destroy the West, which means primarily the United States. Hopefully I'll remember later on in the sermon, but something really hit me a few days ago that along those lines. Anyway, look at the next map here. This is the Crusades. The Crusades started in 1095. The Muslims had been threatening the Christian world, the Catholic world, for a long time, for 300, 400 years. And finally, the Pope got upset and called the leaders of Europe together and said, you know, we need a crusade against these people. So all these different armies came together and they invaded what we today would call the Holy Land or Israel. And they took control of it for about 75, 80 years. The movie The Kingdom of Heaven is about that, part of that period where where the Christians ruled Jerusalem, and then they were driven out by Saladin. And the Crusades went on for a couple of hundred years. So this, again, was a major clash between Islam and Christianity. Whenever I use the word Christianity here, remember, it is Roman Catholicism we're talking about, and later on, Orthodox Christianity as well. We're not talking about the kind of Christianity that Jesus Christ brought to the world. So this is the Second and Third Crusades. There aren't many good maps of the Crusades, but at least it gives you an idea as to how things were at that particular time. Okay, the next one. The Ottoman Empire, everything colored purple there, the Ottomans were Turks, and they went from Turkey and they spread out into all those different countries. They got half of Europe, they got to Vienna in Europe trying to spread Islam, and then they were driven back by Catholic forces in Vienna in 1683. The Poles, the Austrians, and some others as well were combined together there to defeat the Turks. And then gradually the Turkish Empire was driven back. The next map shows that. Gradually you see all these different countries breaking away from the Turks, but many of them remained Muslim. And of course in the Balkans in Southeast Europe, you had three religions left behind when the Turks left. You had Islam, Catholicism, and Orthodoxy. And that led to all the wars we saw 10 years ago. Remember Serbia? Those wars seem like ancient history now. But those were wars between those three different religions. And, we ended up backing the Serbs, the Orthodox Christians, backing the Muslims against the Serbs, against the Orthodox Christians. And, you think that would put us in a better light with the Muslims. But, they still see the United States and other Western countries as the, major threat. So that's the decline of the Ottoman Empire. Then at the end of World War I, you have the British dominating the Middle East, the next map. For most of the 19th century and part of the 20th century, the world was dominated by the British in red, the British Empire, and the blue bit, the United States. The British Empire was 13.9 million square miles. The United States is about 3.9 million. So the British Empire was much bigger and more powerful in the sense that no other nation rivaled it, whereas America's always had other nations challenging its supremacy. And also its longevity. The British Empire lasted a couple of hundred years. America's domination has lasted 60 years. So this was this period of domination here. Notice the next map here. This is the British domination of the Middle East, which continued until the end of World War II. So the British were in Iraq, in Egypt, in Sudan, Aden, India. And it was all pretty much kept under control, not perfectly, but it was effective in keeping the area under control. The British also had control of Palestine, and eventually, just after World War II, the United Nations, the British said they couldn't cope with Palestine anymore, and the United Nations basically gave birth to Israel. But the only reason they were able to do it is because at that time, there were very few Muslim countries, independent countries. If the Muslim countries had been in the UN at that time, they would have voted against Israel. So Israel was really a mistake. In fact, Richard Cohen, who writes for the Washington Post, wrote an article a couple of weeks ago that shocked everybody. With a name like Cohen, he's Jewish. And he wrote this article and said, Israel should always remember the country is a mistake. It should not exist. And he says, when the rest of the world realizes that, they will dump Israel, is what he's basically saying. And that's an interesting point. And that's, a New York Jew writing that, or a Washington Jew writing that particular article. But the Bible shows, the Jews will be there right up until the end. And to me, that's a good indication of us being in the end times, because I don't see how the Jews can hold out indefinitely against all the Muslim world. Anyway, now just to show you the changing face here of things in the Middle East, here's the new Middle East, all the different countries, all independent, Basically, none of them get along with each other. But what you've got now, and there's no maps on this because it's been so sudden. Tony Blair talked about this the other night in Los Angeles. He was talking about how there is an arc of extremism through the Middle East. And he was talking really about the Shia Islam, the extremists. Now, I don't have a laser pointer unless somebody's got one in their pocket. I'll have to explain this. But you see Iran on the right. Well, Iran, of course, is Shiite Islam. And the Iranians are religious fanatics. It's a theocracy. The country is a theocracy. It is ruled by the clerics. And they believe that, the 12th Imam is coming back in a few years' time. And it is their job to stir up chaos and conflict with the Western world to prepare the way for the return of the 12th Imam. In fact, some believe, including the president of Iran, that the whole world must be Islamic before the 12th Imam will come back. But Iran has a lot of oil and a lot of money. Iran is supporting the Shia in Iraq, who are 60% or almost two-thirds of the Iraqis are Shia. And as soon as the United States pulls out of Iraq, the Shia will just take over, or at least they'll try to. You know, a couple of generals this week said it's on the verge of civil war. And if the Shia take over, then Iran becomes even more powerful. And what makes your oil price go up, by the way, is the fear that the Iranians will block the Persian Gulf on the right there and stop oil from coming out, which, you know, they could try and do that. And they reckon if that happened, oil would go up to $100 or even $200 a barrel, which would mean you'd be paying $10 or more a gallon at the pump if it was available. But anyway, the Shia in Iran also, you know, there's a lot of Shia in Iraq. They finance Syria. And then in Lebanon, Hezbollah, the party of God, which is fighting against Israel, has the backing of the Iranians. That's where they get their missiles from. And then on the West Bank, and in Gaza, the Palestinians also get a lot of their finances and their rockets and everything from Iran. So Iran has very suddenly become a major power in the region. And this is Shia Islam. And, you know, Tony Blair acknowledged tacitly in his interview the other night, Tuesday night I think it was, he acknowledged, we're losing this war against a radical Islam. It's becoming a bigger and bigger problem. And we're losing in Afghanistan as well, which is a separate issue in a way. But again, it's radical Islam. So you see how it has spread. And then even down here now, you've got, just down here in Somalia, that has also fallen to radical Islam. These are people who are pledged to the destruction of Israel and also the destruction of the United States. Now, the leader of Hezbollah, some of the comments that are made, I'll read them when I get back there, are quite astounding. Let's look at the next map. Here again is a map of the Middle East at this time. But look at the next one here. This is the extent of Islam. You know, 50, 60 years ago, none of these countries existed. They were all a part of the British or the French or the Dutch Empire. So they were all kept under control, and now they've got their independence. Some of them were a part of the Russian Empire up in the north, Kazakhstan and others. And now, you see, they're all independent countries, and, you know, they are all exclusively Islam or predominantly Islam, or in the case of India, they have a lot of Muslims. In fact, they have over 200 million, but the dominant religion is Hinduism. So you see the extent of Islam. The darker green bits are Shia Islam, the Shiites. And like I said, Islam is spreading. Islam is the fastest growing religion in the United States. A few years ago when I was visiting Jackson Prison, we used to get a lot of visit requests from there, but we haven't had any for a while. But when I was visiting Jackson Prison, I had to go through the chaplain to visit people. And the chaplain was telling me that at that time, a third of the people in Jackson Prison were Muslims. And then I said, oh, are they immigrants, thinking Muslims from other countries? He said, oh, no. He says, they've all converted here. And, you know, basically what happens is the Saudi Arabia sends imams, religious teachers, into our communities in East Lansing, for example, where the Islamic Center is, and also into the prisons. And they convert people, and it appeals especially to poorer people. I would say, too, to lesser educated people. It's a very simplistic religion without some of the complexities and the mysteries, if you will, of traditional Christianity. So it does appeal to a lot of people, but it certainly is a fast-spreading religion. And, you know, it's quite formidable when you look at that. Okay, if we can, what was the next map? Oh, the next map, I was getting, last week I got into the King of the North, King of the South. We'll leave that one there, okay? So if David can do his thing with this, and I can just get back to my notes here. Thank you. Got some more comments here which are interesting. Oh, I want to read you a letter. I get a lot of letters following articles. Here's one from somebody commenting on the Good News article. He said, I earnestly request your organization to kindly avoid using the word Islamic terrorism in your organization's journal, The Good News. Use the word Muslim terrorist, but not Islamic. Islam is a religion of peace and never, never believes in terrorist activities. So, you know, we do get more and more letters like this, but Islam means submission, submission to Allah. That's all it means, is submission. Why the differentiation with Muslim? You know, I don't know. I'll have to look into that some more. But just listen to this. This is something from about a week ago from the Syrian deputy president. The Quran uses terms that are closer to animals than to humans only with regard to those people, the Jews. Look at the bestiality they demonstrate in the destruction of the Arab, Lebanese, and Palestinian peoples. This is why the people who were given the Torah were likened to a donkey carrying books. They were also likened to apes and pigs, and they are indeed the descendants of apes and pigs, as the Quran teaches us. That's, you know, an official government leader talking about what the Quran says regarding Jews, that they are the descendants of apes and pigs. This is taught in the schools in the Islamic world, and presumably even in Islamic schools here. The United States protested recently to Saudi Arabia that their school textbooks all describe Jews as apes and pigs. And the Saudis have not done anything about it. You know, they can't change that because the religious authorities would get upset. So there's nothing they can do to change that. Here's a couple of statements by Hezbollah Secretary General Nasrallah, who is leading this these attacks on Israel, all these rockets that are going into Israel. He is the head of Hezbollah. He says, the people who were displaced from their homes, talking about the Lebanese people, you know, the Israelis have been hitting back. They're trying to wipe out Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a terrorist organization, and they are very clever. They put their people in apartment blocks where there are, you know, ordinary people. So there's no way the Israelis can get to the terrorists without killing civilians. So this is what Nasrallah says. The people who were displaced from their homes were not displaced by a tsunami, nor by a flood or a volcanic eruption. It was Israel that got them out of their homes. It killed their women and children, armed with an American decision, with American weapons, American missiles. Israel created in this country this blood-soaked, destructive, and saddening scene. Further down, today the entire world knows, the Lebanese, the Arabs, the European countries, and the whole world, who is preventing and thwarting the cessation of the Zionist aggression against Lebanon. It is Bush and his American administration. You know, it has something that struck me when I read that was how, you know, that these people, in fact, turn to Zechariah 14 and then I'll explain it to you. But Zechariah chapters 12 and 14 help us to understand this a bit more clearly. Zechariah 12, God says, behold, in verse 2, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples. Well, you know, and this is really what's happening, not just with Jerusalem, but with Israel as a whole. It's like everybody's drunk. They say things that, you know, are horrible. They say, the you know, some of them say things like Mel Gibson would say, you know. That's how drunk they are, you know. And then afterwards, of course, they might back down a little bit. But they're talking like that all the time. And, you know, they say the most awful things. But, you know, it's interesting that God uses that analogy. It's like everybody's drunk. They can't think straight. When you're drunk, you can't think straight. So they you know, are saying all these things. And they're coming against Israel. And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. Again, this is a heavy weight. There's an obsession amongst the Muslims. They've got to destroy Israel. And it struck me one night this week while I was listening to some of this on some channel, I don't know what. It struck me there's only one way they can bring Israel down. It's only one way they can destroy Israel. And that's by bringing us down. The United States as well. And so I wasn't at all surprised yesterday when the Australian government said that their intelligence showed that 200 suicide bombers left Indonesia this week with the avowed intent of attacking Israel, the US, Britain, and Australia. So it's interesting. This is where it's leading to. And when you think about Bible prophecy, you see how all this does fit. I mean, how are we going to see the beast power, you know, come together? You know, something has to happen to bring us down in some way. I don't mean that we would cease to exist, but I mean we would be knocked out in terms of our preeminence in the world. Look at Zechariah 14 as well. Zechariah 14. It's interesting, there's a lot more criticism of Tony Blair in Britain. In fact, a lot of people, even in his cabinet, want him out because they say he's leaving Britain vulnerable to attack because Britain is supporting the U.S. So there is that concern. So, you know, many people do see that this is what is coming, that the attacks are going to be upon us. In chapter 14 of Zechariah, behold, the day of the Lord is coming. For I will gather all the nations, in verse 2, to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished. Half of the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. In that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west. So, you know, that's never happened before. It's still future. So this is a central focus of Bible prophecy. And we see these things happening. Now, you know, I think it's important that we have the right approach to this based upon our beliefs and our understanding of God. Deuteronomy 28, another thing that I've thought about a great deal lately, Deuteronomy chapter 28, which I believe to be one of the most important chapters of Bible prophecy, because it shows that if the descendants of Israel would keep God's law, then God would bless them. But the more they break God's law, the more they will be cursed. In chapter 28, it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you, because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Blessed shall you be in the city, blessed shall you be in the country, blessed shall be the fruit of your body, the produce of your ground, and so on. And then in verse 15, it shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. And then it lists the things that are going to happen as a result of turning away from God. And I think what is very difficult for us as Christians, because, you know, there are so many things that we love about the country in which we live. You know, we can be very patriotic, but we have to come to understand how God sees things. And there are many things in our society which are really bad. And at some point, God will pull the plug as a result of that. I mean, for example, I don't, you know, want to spend a lot of time on this, but for example, it's been some time since I read what the CDC said regarding the more intimate behavior of Americans. That the average person today, before they get married, has 30 sexual partners in the United States. 30. Now, to show you how things have changed, you know, I look back at Webster's Original Dictionary, 1828. which I have in my possession. Unfortunately, it's a reproduction. I wish it was the original. Then I could retire and live on the proceeds. But it's a reproduction from 1828. You look up the word promiscuous, and it says, you know, any activity outside of, any sexual activity outside of marriage. That was the word, the definition back in 1828. I've got another dictionary, 1982, that defines promiscuity as having multiple partners outside of marriage. Not one. In 1828, just having one outside of marriage made you promiscuous. And it was a bad thing. That's the way Noah Webster explains it. But in 1982, you've got to have multiple partners to be promiscuous. A few years ago, I remember a documentary on PBS. It was while I was in the United States. So I came here in 1990. So let's say 93, 94, around there. This program defined promiscuity as, you know, having more than six partners in a lifetime. Now the CDC defines promiscuity as having more than six partners in a year. That, up to six, and you're not promiscuous. You see how our morals are constantly changing? So up to six partners, you're not promiscuous. Now, you know, Chris, who works with, hopefully I'll get this right, a federally funded AIDS project here in Lansing, was telling me a while ago that the fastest growing incidence of AIDS now, the segment of the population which is seeing the fastest growth in HIV-positive figures is 12 to 15-year-olds. 12 to 15-year-olds here in the United States, okay? Now, I can believe that. Remember a few years ago, I showed that documentary from PBS, The Children of Rockdale County, the richest county in Atlanta, in Georgia, which showed it showed that 300 kids, I think it was, in the high school, had all got syphilis. And with the parents' cooperation and the kids' cooperations, they tried to figure out exactly what was going on, and it went into some of the things that contributed to this. And it was a shocking documentary. You know, it reminds me of a scripture in Hosea chapter 5. Look at Hosea. Hosea 5. Now, this ties in as well with what we're talking about here, about, you know, what is happening in the Middle East. But, you know, we have to understand that, you know, this is happening for a reason. Just write down the scripture, Proverbs 14, verse 34. It says, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. So righteousness exalts a nation. When we were, in the traditional Protestant sense, a Christian nation, a Bible-believing nation, you know, there was a certain respect that was given to us around the world. But it's not there anymore. Carl Thomas even brought this up recently in one of his articles. You know, he said, we think we're a Christian people. He said, over half the people in this country go to church every week. But when they get home, they turn on Desperate Housewives or other TV shows. You know, and we're all at fault in this because we all watch stuff that, you know, we shouldn't watch at times. But, you know, all of that stuff goes out into the rest of the world, even into the Muslim world. And they see these programs and they've lost all respect because we are an immoral people, an immoral nation today. Not just the United States, of course, other Western countries too. But notice here in Hosea chapter 5, beginning in verse 5, the pride of Israel testifies to his face. You know, there's a certain pride. I think one of the real big weaknesses that has contributed to the mess we're in today is the fact that some people thought that we were invincible because we were the greatest power in the world. And, you know, when you start to think that way and you leave God out of the picture, it's not going to be long before you have problems. The pride of Israel testifies to his face. Therefore, Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. Judah also stumbles with them. Notice the Jews and Israel separate here, both stumbling together at the same time. With their flocks and herds, they shall go to seek the Lord, but they will not find him. He has withdrawn himself from them. So, you know, that point is still in the future. It hasn't happened yet. They have dealt treacherously with the Lord, for they have begotten pagan children. Just think about that for a moment. That is so true, and it is so sad. You know, we've got maybe one, two generations now where I would think the majority of our children, in this society in which we live, and even more so where I come from in England than here in the United States, but the majority have not got a concept of anything biblical at all. There is just no knowledge at all. I was talking to my nephew when I was in England last year, and he was asking me, he said, what exactly do you do? So I'm trying to explain my job to somebody who doesn't even know what the Bible is. Do you realize how difficult that is? And hasn't got a concept of anything religious because he's had no religious background at all. And at one point, I remember, I was explaining that his name is Daniel, and I was explaining that every year, you know, I go to ABC, the Ambassador Bible Center, and I teach the book of Daniel. And I realized as I said that, there was this kind of blank stare. What's Daniel? You know, no concept of any of these things. You see what this verse means? You know, they have begotten pagan children. Children who just don't believe. There's no religious thinking at all in the minds of many. There is in some. And of course, some have gotten into other things like New Age stuff and so on, which of course is also pagan. It is not of God. But, you know, it wasn't like that before. There was an incredible respect for the Bible. Remember the book, Wide as the Waters? I used that in a sermon once by Benson Bobrick. He showed how in the 1600s and the 1700s, there was this incredible enthusiasm for the Bible amongst the English-speaking peoples. Americans before the Revolution considered themselves English and called themselves English. And he shows in the book how Englishmen, including Americans, took their Bible with them everywhere as the rock and foundation of their lives. And there were quotes from the 1600s and the 1700s to show the fulfillment of that. And there was this zeal for the Bible. And Jacques Balzan, another historian, writes in his book, From Dawn to Decadence, he writes about how this enthusiasm for the Bible lasted 350 years from the Protestant Reformation until 1900. 1900 was the first year in which more secular books were published than religious books. Of course, they didn't have a perfect understanding of the Bible, and they certainly worshipped on the wrong day. But, you know, they did try to live according to other commandments, and try to live, you know, according to the teachings of the scriptures. And, you know, all of that is gone. It's really gone in the last 40 years. And I can't emphasize that enough. We have gone through in 40 years a 180-degree turn. We really have as a nation. 180 degrees. Is there anything now, anything morally or anything in our way of life which is as it was 50 years ago? You know, that's a challenge for those of you who are even older than I am. You know, is there anything that, you know, is the same? And, you know, you'd find it hard to think of anything. You know, you really would. I mean, it's, you know, we were talking about this a few weeks ago because, you know, on TV sometimes they have these old sitcoms. You look at one of those old sitcoms, I mean, take I Love Lucy. I don't personally like the show, but, you know, you take I Love Lucy, most people have seen that. You know, back then you notice how all the way through an episode they're all smoking away, okay? But you know how if there's a scene in the bedroom, there's two single beds, twin beds, with a definite, decided gap between the two. You notice how they could never drink alcohol. You never see them with a glass of alcohol in their hands. And they never use bad language, okay? Today it's exactly the reverse. Now nobody can smoke on any of these TV shows. That's the greatest sin anybody can commit. But, you know, there's a lot of bed scenes, and they're not two separate beds anymore. There's also a lot of bad language, especially if it's cable. And additionally, you know, they drink a lot. So a total reversal of our morality. So is it any wonder that, you know, here we see, you know, God talking about how they've begotten pagan children, the first generation, and not just one generation, but really the last two generations, that really just has very little knowledge of God. Then it says at the end of verse 7, now a new moon shall devour them and their heritage. That refers back to verse 5, Israel, Ephraim, and Judah. Judah, the Jews that we call Israel today. Ephraim, the multitude of nations, very little is left. You know, the multitude of nations, when I was a child, was still a great force in the world. Lots of different countries, all united under the crown, but totally independent countries. And the United States is the dominant nation of Israel today. So I think this is referring to the United States, Britain, Australia, Canada, and the Jews. You know, again, this is who the terrorists are coming after to bring us down, because they want to totally eradicate the nation of Israel from the face of the earth. And it's hard for us to understand that. Look at Leviticus 26. It's hard for us to understand this obsession with Israel, but, you know, it really goes back to Abraham. Abraham's two sons. We don't have time to go into that now, but Abraham's two sons, you know, the one that was the child of promise, Isaac, and the other one, so his handmaid, Hagar, Ishmael. In fact, just keep your finger in Leviticus 26 for a moment and look at Genesis 16. Genesis 16 and verse 12, talking about Ishmael, there was this prophecy, he shall be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. So, you know, this was a prophecy regarding the descendants of Ishmael, and the Arabs are the descendants of Ishmael. Not all Muslims are Arabs. In fact, most Muslims are not Arabs. But Islam came out of the Arab world. And this is very much, you know, the way that the people are in the Arab world. In fact, they were noted for that in Muhammad's time. They were always at each other's throats. Leviticus 26 says this regarding the modern descendants of Israel. In verse 19, I will break the pride of your power. But in verse 16, I will also do this to you. I will even appoint terror over you. You know, terrorism would come as a result of turning away from God's laws. And that's exactly, you know, what is happening now and what is going to happen. And I'm sure it's going to be, you know, a big factor in the years to come. Look at Luke 21, because, you know, as we look at all of this and think about the future, you know, we are going to have a period of peace. I'm convinced of that. So, you know, that's going to be a good thing, at least for a while. But let's have a look at some scriptures, because we have to be concerned primarily with our spiritual state. And, you know, I think the golden principle is this, that, you know, that this is very biblical, that we live every day, spiritually, we live every day as if it is our last day. So we are always prepared for the return of Jesus Christ. Physically, we prepare as if we're going to live to a ripe old age. So plan for retirement. And that's the right approach, I think, to prophecy. It really is. Spiritually, to plan as if your life could end at any moment, because it could. But physically, we prepare as if we're going to die at a ripe old age. And we plan as previous generations have planned. Luke 21, verse 34, in talking about his second coming, Christ said, Take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. And I mean, really, that is what I would say most people in our society today are into. Carousing, drunkenness, cares of this life are more important than God. Matthew 13, verse 22. Matthew 13 and verse 22. The parable of the sower here. Now he who receives seed among the thorns is he who hears the word, and the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becomes unfruitful. You know, there's lots of scriptures where Christ warns against the world. And here we see how the influences of the world can choke us and stop us from being the kind of Christians that God wants to see. 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 14. The Apostle Peter is writing about the day of the Lord and the time in the future when we see the imminency of Christ's return in verse 14. Therefore, beloved, looking forward to these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, without spot and blameless. So, you know, strive for perfection is what is telling us. Strive for perfection. There's a passage in 2 Timothy, really, which I think warns us against the way in which the world has become. And again, this is very much a part of the Western world. You know, I see a lot of things that are very different from when, you know, from when I was younger, and many of you do too. And it's sad. I think it's much more difficult, I think, to have children at this time than it was even 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. You know, I've often said that when I was a child growing up, I mean, I could leave home in the morning and just go off and play, and, you know, my parents didn't worry themselves at all. You know, I could be gone for hours. Now, you know, a lot of parents give their kids, really young kids, cell phones, or they, you know, make them stay in the backyard or put them in daycare because they're afraid of the children can't go out and do what they want anymore. There's too many dangers out there. And that is true. There are. But there was a time when it wasn't like that. And, you know, there was a time when most people who married stayed married. And that isn't the case today. You know, only 40% of the children born now will live with both mom and dad to the age of 16. Only 40%. At one time, it was over 90% would live with mom and dad to the age of 16. Now it's only 40%. Another change in just the last 40 years. Paul wrote to Timothy and said this: "Know this, that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves." You know, and really, I think that has very much become the way that, you know, many people are, lovers of themselves, lovers of money and so on. So, you know, there's a warning there. We should not be like that. So we should be very concerned about our spiritual state and, you know, realize that it is the way that our society has become that is the cause of so many of these problems and the reason why we need to pray so fervently, "Thy kingdom come." That's the example of the prayer that Jesus Christ gave us in Matthew chapter 6, to pray, "Thy kingdom come." Finally, look at Revelation chapter 6. I wonder if we're in this time period as well. Revelation 6, in fact, there is one more scripture after this I'll have to look at. But here in Revelation 6, it talks about the four horsemen, and it mentions in verses 1 and 2 false religion, and shows how those lead to war in verses 3 and 4, which is the sequence that we're going through at this particular time. But look at Matthew 24. That's a better place for us to finish, I think, Matthew 24, because it ends with the kingdom of God. And, you know, that is very positive and something that we must stay focused upon, no matter what the challenges and difficulties are in the world. The kingdom of God is central to God's thinking, and, you know, he is looking forward to the establishment of his kingdom, to the return of his son, Jesus Christ. So Matthew 24, verse 3. "As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming, and at the end of the age?'" Not the end of the world, as so many on TV keep talking about. "Jesus answered and said to them, 'Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many.'" A reference to false religions, including even Islam, false messiahs. "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." So, you know, these are not things that should trouble us. We know these things have to happen for Christ to return. "The nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. All these are the beginning of sorrows," in verse 8. Then he mentions tribulation. "They will deliver you up to tribulation." But go further down to verse 29. In fact, verse 22 first, and then verse 29. Verse 22. "Unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." So for the elect's sake, you know, Jesus Christ intervenes to stop man from destroying himself for the sake of the elect, those who have been called out of this world and who are following Jesus Christ and keeping the commandments. For the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. And this is one reason why it is so important for us, you know, as those that have been called, to make sure that we in our own lives are living a way which is pleasing to God. Because it is for the elect's sake that those days will be shortened. that these things will come to an end. Verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. You know, most nations will not be happy at this time, because they really do not want God to intervene. You know, it's interesting that how, you know, Satan's twisted things around. It is the gospel of the kingdom, the good news of the kingdom. But then you get, you know, all these people on TV talking about the end of the world, see, which is not what he talked about. He talked about the end of the age and the coming of the kingdom of God. But then in verse 31, he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. You know, and that's when Christ returns, the resurrection takes place, the kingdom of God is established. And, you know, that is the central message of Bible prophecy and what we look forward to. So it's not a time to be worried about the things that are taking place. It is certainly awful to see what is happening to people in Israel and Lebanon and other countries around the world. And it should make us pray more fervently for the return of Jesus Christ and the establishment of the kingdom. But we ourselves need to be focused upon that and make sure that we are pleasing to God in our own lives.